So in July, I'm at a coffee shop in Bethesda, Maryland, with my laptop, trying to decide on what to preach on December 4th. And I often look at a colleague's sermons on the same date, and I found that in December 4th, 1996, a colleague, Reverend David Bumbaugh, had preached a sermon in New Jersey on this topic. And I thought, well, that's a good idea. So I listed that as the topic. And then this week, I actually had to write the sermon. That is a way of saying, I did not plan this in any relationship to the election results. The Christian doctrine of original sin is the idea that we are born evil and sinful because Adam and Eve's rebellion in Eden. According to this negative view of human nature, strict parenting is important to teach children to control their evil impulses. The December Santa Claus myth, where children are only rewarded when they are good and punished with cold gifts when they are bad, that is based on this negative view of human nature. But over three centuries ago, Enlightenment philosophers in places like Glasgow and Edinburgh proposed a different, more optimistic view of human nature. They argued that we're born good. They said, just look at a baby's face soon after it's born when it's not crying. The innocence, the goodness that you see. We are born rational, cooperative, tolerant, and loving. Religious liberals, including Quakers, Unitarians, and Universalists, embrace this Enlightenment view that we are born good and that we only do evil acts because of environmental influences such as child abuse or drug abuse. This led to the creation of positive, optimistic statements about human nature. For example, in 1935, at its national meeting in Washington, D.C., the Universalist Church of America adopted as its statement of belief, "We avow our faith in the supreme worth of every human personality." It is an affirmation, a positive view of human nature. A few years later, in 1960, when the Unitarians and the Universalists were in the process of negotiating a merger which was to come in 1961, but ahead of time, in 1960, they were discussing what their statement of purpose would be in their new bylaws, and they agreed on this statement. The members of the Unitarian Universalist Association unite in seeking to affirm, defend, and promote the supreme worth of every human personality. In 1985, we revised this, and at a general assembly of our association, the assembled delegates voted this revision. We, the member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association, covenant to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Well, what does inherent mean in this context? It suggests that every human being is born with dignity and worth. We are equal at the start, inherently. Now, over the 39 years of my own ministry, I have had a number of conversations with men and women in the congregations that I have served concerning this particular statement. Do we really believe, they frequently ask, in the inherent worth and dignity of every person? Frequently, then, they give a recitation of human cruelty and wonder that any thinking people can affirm the worth of such individuals. How, they ask me, can you affirm the inherent worth and dignity of Hitler or Stalin? Or, to bring the matter closer to home, then they tell a story of an event that's just happened. For example, can you affirm the inherent worth and dignity of the man in Ohio who ran into pedestrians with his car on Monday and injured 11 people with a butcher knife? Is it not possible that some people, by their actions, have removed themselves beyond the embrace of our common concern and care? Are some people fundamentally evil and therefore without inherent worth and dignity? Well, to answer these very important questions about human nature, I turn to science. Edward Osborne Wilson is an expert at Harvard University on the study of ants. I tried to actually meet him at a lecture in Washington about a year ago, and there was the line of thousands of people was so great I couldn't get into the room. Edward Osborne Wilson. He's part of an intellectual movement of biologists who have studied the behavior of insects, birds, fish, and mammals, and in the last 50 years have applied the same approach to the study of the human animal. In 1978, Wilson wrote a book called On Human Nature. He suggested that we engage in what we call evil behavior as human beings when we believe that the resources necessary for our survival are threatened. He suggested that when ant colonies grow so large that there's not enough food to feed all the ants, they go to war with nearby ant colonies. So imagine this field outside Sarasota where there's this group of several peaceful groups of ant colonies with their each of their own mounds, and they're doing fine, but they population increases and increases until they're almost touching each other, and the resources of food for all the ants are becoming limited. When this happens, they go to war. They fight until so many ants die that there is enough food left to feed the remaining ants. Wilson says that human beings behave in the same way. Other justifications, he says, that people give for their evil acts, such as religious differences or political differences, are, in Wilson's view, a veneer that covers the real reason: fear of death due to scarce resources. When we believe we have enough resources, which most Unitarians have and have had during my whole lifetime, when we have enough resources, it's easy for us to say we believe in the inherent worth and dignity of all the people on the earth. However, Wilson argues, when we believe we're running out of resources necessary for our survival, phrases such as all men, all people are created equal, and we believe in the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Statements like we believe in justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. When we're worried about our survival because of scarce resources, we stop saying these words. Instead, we believe in the worth and dignity of our tribe. In our case, our tribe is most of the time the citizens of the United States or the citizens of Australia. While the people whom we are fighting for the resources with, the people who we feel threaten our survival, they're the others. The people in Mexico who want our jobs. And they have no right to our limited resources. Wilson is suggesting that only ants who have enough food to survive believe that all ants have worth and dignity. And only people who feel they have enough resources to survive believe that every human being has inherent worth and dignity. Wilson challenges our belief in the inherent worth and dignity of all people by saying that I can only hold that belief as long as I have adequate food and shelter, and I feel that my survival and the survival of my family and friends is not seriously endangered. Well, I decided then to look at some other books. And desiring to understand this, I turned to a researcher named Philip Zimbardo. He is famous for his Stanford prison experiment back in the 1960s, when he randomly divided volunteers. They were students who were looking to earn a little extra money, into prisoners and guards. Zimbardo had to end the experiment early when the randomly selected pretend guards started to abuse the randomly selected pretend prisoners. He wrote a book on this study and others that he's done called The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil. He writes that a powerful force in transforming human behavior, a powerful force pushing across the boundary between good and evil, comes from the desire to be in and not out. Wilson would argue that we have evolved to want to be in the in-group because being part of a group enhances our chances of survival. We've evolved to feel a terror at being left outside because on our own, it is difficult to survive. We are able and willing to commit what we would call evil acts to stay part of the in-group. Consciously and unconsciously, we want to stay part of the group so that we and our families will survive. Zimbardo documents this. A Hutu mother described how she had beaten to death the children next door, who she said looked at her with wide-eyed amazement because they had been friends and neighbors all their lives. With the urging and encouragement and support of a group, he said, any deed that any human being has ever committed, however horrible, is possible for any of us. This behavior suggests that human beings are not inherently worthy and dignified, and that we are all capable of very ugly behavior. Well, I wasn't happy with his conclusion. So I read another book. In 1995, David Grossman published a book called On Killing, The Psychological Cost of Learning to Kill in War and Society. This is a book that actually, I understand, is required reading in our military schools and by people who are studying to be FBI agents. The Psychological Cost of Learning to Kill in War and Society. Grossman documents that soldiers often intentionally fire over the enemy's head or do not fire their guns at all. During World War II, one British lieutenant said that the only way he could get his men to stop firing into the air was by drawing his sword, walking down the trench, beating them on the backside, and telling them to fire low. In World War II, a United States Army brigade general reported that during battle, the firing rate was a mere 15 to 20%. Out of every 100 men engaged in a firefight, only 15 to 20 actually used their weapons. And in Vietnam, for every enemy soldier killed, more than 50,000 bullets were fired. One general concluded, "The vast majority of combatants throughout history, at the moment of truth, when they could and should kill the enemy, have found themselves to be conscientious objectors." The research indicates that the majority of men on the battlefield would not attempt to kill the enemy, even to save their own lives or the lives of their friends. And this suggests that human beings are inherently worthy and dignified, that we actually have a great deal of difficulty when we are expected to engage in destructive acts. Well, at some point I had to stop reading and make sense of all of this. And for me, it comes together in Charles Darwin's theory of natural selection. For a species as a whole to survive and to adapt to changing environments, the individuals of that species need to exhibit a wide variety of traits. Some of us have brown eyes, some of us blue, some of us have brown hair, some of us have blonde hair, and some of us are born to be saints, and some of us are not born to be saints. To survive, a species needs a wide variety of traits. This suggests to me that a few of us are programmed genetically to engage in deceitful, manipulative, and even sadistic behavior. And then a few of us are born to use charm, manipulation, and intimidation to control others and to satisfy our selfish needs. A few of us are born without a conscience, and we are cold-bloodedly able to take what we want and do as we please, violating social norms and expectations without any sense of guilt or regret or willingness to apologize. Now, researchers have identified one of the genes that influences our moral sense. There's science behind this. It's named the MAOA gene, or in popular literature, it's become known as the warrior gene. The effects of low MAO genes were first identified in 1993 in a large Dutch family that was notorious for aggressive behavior. One family member attempted to run his boss over with his car. Another stabbed a warden in the chest with a pitchfork. Still another entered his sister's rooms at night armed with a knife and forced them to undress. All of them, when the genetic study was done, all of them had this warrior gene. In 2002, a New Zealand study was published suggesting that children with the warrior gene, who are also abused, mistreated by their parents, are 9 times more likely to be violent as adults. The presence of the warrior gene did not predict antisocial outcomes in the whole population. Its relationship to aggression only emerged when the researchers considered whether the children had been abused when they were younger. Research conducted by Bethesda's National Institute of Mental Health concluded that this warrior gene weakens the brain's impulse control. It increases the risk that a person will be antisocial. Now, the word risk here is very important. Genes are about risk, not about fate. In February of 2007, in the journal Child Development, a study of adult twins and their children had similar results. Researchers found that genes, rather than the parents' behavior, seemed key in the children's odds of serious conduct problems, like bullying, skipping school, and shoplifting. Disobedient youngsters aren't simply copying the behavior they may have been subject to at home. Instead, traits such as bullying, lying, or being argumentative appear to be passed on in the genes. The research from the Department of Psychology at the University of Virginia indicates that some children behave badly no matter how loving or caring an environment they grew up in. The study suggests that behavioral trends are inherited in the same way as eye and hair color. Abusive children raised with a combination of having this particular gene variant and being abused may put children on a track for serious antisocial behavior later in life. Researchers also looked closely at adopted children, children who adopted into a family, and discovered again that the environment the child was growing up in, coupled with the strength of a particular gene, determined their behavioral patterns as they became adults. The most recent research is in a paper published in July from researchers in Finland. It showed that Finnish criminals convicted of several violent crimes frequently possess the warrior gene, while nonviolent controls did not. Of course, the question I wonder is, if this shows that there's a variety of traits, how many people have this violent, aggressive tendency? Well, we don't know the answer, but researchers are willing to speculate, and some guess it's about 2% of the population. We have evolved to protect our tribe, to protect our families. When we think our tribe is threatened, then we call on this small 2% who are programmed genetically to be more inclined to be willing to kill, to torture, to lie, to manipulate, to protect the tribe. So in a random sample of the human population, there is a bell curve with a small percentage of people who are capable of these very destructive acts, and a small percentage of saints, and then the rest of us who are somewhere in the middle between these two extremes. One man who had worked his lifetime for the CIA came and talked to me as he was dying about his memorial service, and he said, "I was recruited out of college. You know, they should have recruited people from prison, not from college, to ask them to do what I was asked to do in World War II. Human evolution, with this diversity in our gene pool, because of occasional shortages of food and other essential resources, we've evolved to have this diversity. When, for a particular tribe, resources are plentiful and are perceived to be plentiful, we can affirm and proclaim the inherent worth and dignity of every person. The tribe selects as leaders people who are kind and loving and fair, people who are closer to the saint side of that bell curve to run our country. On the other hand, when our tribe fears that the resources and therefore their way of life and their survival is threatened, we divide the world up into two groups, those who are part of our tribe and everyone else. The tribe selects as leaders people who will shoot directly at the enemy, not over their heads. Fearing for our survival, we select as leaders people we think will protect us because they have no qualms about engaging in violence. In an economic downturn, our tribe, the United States of America, turns against members of other tribes, such as people from Mexico or from China or wherever. We use aggression to limit others' access to what we think are scarce resources, resources we think we need for survival. We slide into hostility because we are afraid our survival and the survival of our friends and family are at stake. Now, three centuries ago, Enlightenment philosophers proposed a different, more optimistic view of human nature. They argued that humans are born good. We are born rational, cooperative, tolerant, and loving. It helped that the economy of Scotland was doing very well during the Enlightenment because of the tobacco trade with Virginia. They were quite flush. Religious liberals, including my denomination, the Unitarian Universalist Association, have embraced this enlightened view that we are all born good and only do evil acts because of environmental influences such as child abuse or drug abuse. We say that we affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And in these words, I hear this long history of our movement echoing down from the corridors of Edinburgh and Scotland and the other Enlightenment capitals. The insistence upon our need to open the circle of love to include not only those who are like us, but also those who are not like us. It serves to challenge the manner in which we build walls around ourselves, walls which strengthen fear and resentment and distrust of those who are different from us. Now, I'm not blind to the fact that a small number of human beings, perhaps 2%, are capable of leading the rest of us to destroy each other like different tribes of ants on a field. We empower that 2% when we are afraid of our survival. If we're deeply afraid, this 2% can lead us to radically remove ourselves from the human sphere, lead us to commit monstrous acts of inhumanity. I've served as a Unitarian Universalist minister for 39 years. And if I had to sum up my work over those years, it has been to say over and over again, we are all one human family, all of us. And the genetic research proves my point. There's no Unitarian Universalist tribe. There's no Jewish tribe. There's no white male American tribe. There's no African American tribe. There is no Mexican tribe or Chinese tribe or Islamic tribe. We are one human family. And if we work together, there are enough resources on earth to feed, clothe, and shelter all of us in a moderate, reasonable way. There's enough resources for a few of us to be incredibly wealthy and the rest of us to struggle, or there is enough resources for all of us to live moderate lives. That is what I mean when I say I affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. We are all one human family.